Alrighty, we're going to get started and call a meeting to order the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee and start out with the roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Hertas.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam. Representative Rosenthal.
Here.
Representative Schoen.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler.
Here.
And Representative Zerwas.
Here.
Okay, a quorum being present here, we'll ask someone to move the minutes of March 11th. Representative O'Neill moves the minutes of March 11th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Okay, it's fun day, gun day at the Capitol. And I'm just going to tell you the basic rules. What we're going to do is have a pretty open meeting. We're not going to put any time limits on anybody. We're going to have all of the supporters come up first, and then we're going to have all the opposition after that. And then we'll try something a little fun. We'll have a rebuttal at the end of equal time by both parties. The supporters will come up for a couple of minutes, and the opposition will come up for a couple of minutes, because sometimes you always wish there was something that you would have said or cleared up or qualified. And so we're not going to limit any questions or any answers, and I think so everybody will be satisfied at the end. That's why we're coming back tonight, and we'll stay to midnight if we have to, and get all the questions answered, and I'm looking forward to a good day. We would ask that we keep rhetoric out of it and smart aleck comments and this and that. Those of you who were at the hearings before, sometimes we cheer or boo. We'd ask that you not do that for both the support and the opposition, so we keep it orderly and move fast. We could probably get all three of these bills done actually by noon. I don't think they're all that controversial as some, like guns on campus and the Castle Doctrine and other bills that I've had. So we should be in good shape. And if not, we'll come back. And there won't be any surprise votes or any trickery today. I'm going to have GOP and there's going to be DFL moving in and out at different times. One thing I would like the media to know and the people in the public to know is that legislators don't just have this to do. There's some of us that have to be in two other places and news conferences and all. So if you see somebody walking out, they're not avoiding a vote. They're well, I can't say particularly about that, but that's what they've been accused of in the past. But don't just infer that's happening because we got so many things going on. And we'll make sure that everybody is here and had ample time to get back before a vote is taken today. So we've got three bills up. Some are more controversial than others. Oh, the other thing that I would ask is that we base our decisions and things today, and my members also, on fact and not fear. You just after the whole day gets done and all the testimony, just think about not what could happen, what might happen, but what's happened in the past and what the actual facts are that we put out. Naturally, be open to your own opinion after all of that. But remember, try not to cheer or jeer anybody. Any questions? Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I do appreciate that you're not going to put time limits and you're going to allow everybody to have the opportunity to speak and understand that members are going to come and go. I do have one question. So I assume that folks may have an opinion on more than one proposal. So are you asking that if the person comes to testify that they tell you their opinion just on that one proposal and then each proposal they would come up again and say what their position was? I just want to make sure that we know whether folks should keep their comments to the proposal before them, or if they come up once, if they should say everything they have to say.
Oh, thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Well, we'd like to restrain your comments to the bill at hand, if that's what you mean.
Yes, that's exactly.
We'll take these bills one at a time, and please don't look ahead or talk about things that are bothering you about other bills or issues. Just keep it constrained to the restrained to the bill at hand. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. All right, are we ready? The first bill up will be Representative Nash, House File 372, and I believe Will all these three go to the register? All three of these bills will go straight to the general register or attempt to.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you, and I would like to...
Well, I'll move your bill for you.
I appreciate that, and I just wanted to point out that, unfortunately, Chair Davids is not with us here today. He would remind you that I am a freshman and owe you all treats, so I brought them accordingly. So appreciate that.
All right. I'll move your bill, House File 372, be recommended to pass and move to the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 372, I would consider, as the Chair said, a very non-controversial bill. It provides for folks who have been successfully issued a permit to carry after undergoing training and scrutiny to have that constitute notification here at the Capitol grounds. In previous iterations of things, folks have had to do a separate and what is realistically a redundant step for notification to carry here at the Capitol grounds. And it is my assertion that it is redundant. It does no additional does not provide any additional security, does not provide any additional actionable items for the members of the people who have to provide us security here on the Capitol grounds. And therefore, we would like to assert that the successful issuance of a permit to carry is now going to constitute notification to carry here in the Capitol grounds. I do have some testifiers, and would like to call them up. Mr. Rothman, I believe. And I also have Lieutenant Colonel Schroefer, who will be testifying as well.
You're welcome, sir. If you state your name and organization you represent, and begin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Rothman. I'm the president of Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, a civil rights group that has been in Minnesota since 1989. The history of carry in Minnesota has a few steps in it. Before 1974, there were no state laws relating to the carry of a pistol. In 1974, we had a May issue carry law passed, which means that permit applicants would have to ask their police chief or sheriff for permission to get a permit to carry, and those police chiefs or sheriffs could say yes or no. For the next 20 years until 1994, there were no reported problems with permit holders at the state capitol. In 1994, however, there was a state representative whose mother was concerned about his safety at the state capitol. The state capitol security really didn't know who had a carry permit in Minnesota, even though there'd never been a problem at the capitol, and this concerned Representative Rhodes at the time. And so he had a floor amendment in the House that added the requirement to notify the Commissioner of Public Safety before a permit holder could carry at the capitol or in any building in the capitol area. The capitol area, or any state building in the capitol area, the capitol area is defined for zoning purposes, and it extends several blocks north of University and south across the highway and includes the History Center, among other state buildings. It made some sort of sense in 1994 because these carry permits were issued by more than 500 separate police organizations, police chiefs and sheriffs around the state. And when they issued a carry permit, they would take the card and they'd roll it into their Selectric typewriter, and they would type that card, and then they'd put a piece of paper in a file cabinet in Kendi Ohi County or in Duluth or in Rochester, and that's where the only record would be. So in 1994, it did make a little bit of sense to notify the Commissioner of Public Safety, not that there'd ever been a problem. Well, in 2003, we passed the Shall Issue Carry Law, which says that any law-abiding person who takes a class and passes a background check and has a clean history as far as drug abuse and mental health can get a permit to carry. There are 190,000 people who have that permit to carry now. In 2003, the legislature appropriated $1.2 million to the Commissioner of Public Safety for the purposes of creating a statewide database of every single permit holder in the state. And so when a sheriff issues a carry permit, there is a transmission of that data immediately to the state, where it's available to every police officer and sheriff's deputy in the state 24/7, 365. At that moment, the capital notification became redundant and an anachronism. And yet since 1994, carry permit holders have had to make that notification even since they were in the database until after 2003. So for the last 13 years, carry permit holders law-abiding folks who've proven it, who wanted to come to the Capitol would have to send a letter to the Commissioner of Public Safety saying, "Dear Commissioner, I'm in your database." So this notification has become redundant since 2003. It certainly is now. And since between 1974 and today, we've still had no problems with permit holders at the state capitol. I recommend that you ask Lieutenant Colonel Schroefer when she comes up what she's aware of the history of carry permit holders at the capitol. I think that you'll get a pretty favorable answer. When you make this notification, it's good for life. And so I notified in 2003 when I got my first carry permit, and here we are 13 years later, and that notification is still good. And so it's pretty clear that it doesn't provide any actual safety mechanism, that it's just a piece of paperwork whose time has gone. Thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rothman. This one-time notification, is that law? It seems to be a little vague around that. I don't know if you have the answer to it or if our staff has the answer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenthal, it is law. It's in Minnesota Statute 609.66, Subdivision 1F, and it requires that notification be made. It doesn't specify any expiration for that, and so it has been the position of the Department of Public Safety that one-time notification is sufficient as long as that person is a permit holder.
You want to hear from research?
Yes, please, Mr.
Mr. Chair and members, that's an accurate representation of the law. It's a very general requirement to provide notice to the commissioner of your intent, whether you come to the Capitol or not. Once provided, there's no provision for expiration of that notice.
So, Mr. Rothman, in summary, then, instead of calling back to the Capitol Security and asking them to look in their three-ring binder for the permit notification, all they have to really do now is just instantly search the database and get rid of the three-ring binder, I would imagine. Would that be accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nash? Members, I think that's an accurate depiction. The current file system is a paper-based system. And we've heard a lot here since I've been here, and yeah, I'm a freshman, so it's only been a few months. We've talked about a lot of technological solutions. We've got a database that we appropriated $1.2 million for. The database is accessible after hours, where the paper file isn't necessarily available after hours. We've got the database that is updated daily as people around the state are issued their permit to carry. The hanging file doesn't necessarily do that. The paper file in the office. And I think the most important thing to recognize about the database solution versus the paper solution is this, that somewhere on the Capitol grounds, the many buildings that compose the Capitol grounds, there may be someone who comes, and we'll use the History Center, for example, who hasn't notified because, as Mr. Rothman can attest to, the requirements to teach that notification is not present in law for permit to carry instructors. So someone could come from, let's say, the Iron Range somewhere, and come to visit the History Center, and they don't have that notification submitted. They are now a felon, because that is in law. They have committed a felony. And we think that this is a more elegant and technology-oriented solution that works for all Minnesotans who have gone to the trouble to go through the training, go through the scrutiny, pay their county sheriff to acquire the permit. So, yes, Mr. Chair, you're right in saying that the paper file is much slower and not as robust, and it really doesn't work for the folks who are here to protect us. And I think that this might be a good time to call the Lieutenant Colonel down if she wouldn't mind joining us. There she is.
Good morning, Colonel. If you'd give us your name and title and organization, and go ahead and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representatives. My name is Shelley Schroefer, and I'm Lieutenant Colonel with the Minnesota State Patrol. My primary intent here this morning is to give an overview of the notification system, the process that between the Commissioner's Office and Capitol Security, as well as answer any questions that you may have about that process. When a permit holder sends a notification to the Commissioner, That notification can come in a couple different forms. Typically, it's email or hard copy. However, it could come in just about any form because the form of the notification isn't defined currently under statute. Once the commissioner's office receives that notification, they fairly immediately turn that around to Capital Security. Capital Security takes in that information, and we record a first name, a last name, a date of birth if it's provided, and the date of notification. And we file that in a running log. It's a hard copy log. And just a little bit of point of clarification of Rep. Nash here. That log is kept in our dispatch center. Our dispatch center is a 24/7 operation, so we do have access to that 24/7. If we happen to observe somebody on the complex who's carrying a pistol, law enforcement officer will approach that individual. We will ask them if they have a valid permit to carry. And we will make a CJIS check on that permit to ensure that the permit is valid and it's not expired. Once we receive that information, we then would contact our dispatch center to verify whether or not a notification has been received by the commissioner's office. It's a very simple process. It's a short process, and that really sums it up. As Rep. Nash mentioned, if we do have someone on the complex who is carrying a pistol and they have a valid permit to carry, but they are not in the notification system, they have not notified the commissioner, they would be subject to felony charges as the statute is today.
And that, members, is one of the reasons why we're here, what we call the trap. We would rather not have somebody be charged with a felony and under this notification procedure. And so back to the summary of what's happening here, we would just like to get rid of the paper mess and go to the instant notification. Representative Hillstrom, followed by Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many people have been referred for felony charges based on this lack of notification?
None to my knowledge.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I continue to expand the Capitol complex because I want Capitol Security to protect more areas. And so is there a map someplace of what areas would be included for folks to know that if they happen to go to one of the buildings on the other side of the highway, that's part of the Capitol complex? Or is there anywhere place where people can get actual notification of what is the Capitol complex?
Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is defined in statute. So if someone were to go to the statute, they can see exactly, specifically, what boundaries are laid out for the Capitol complex.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have signage up that says, you know, if you're going to carry on the Capitol complex, that you need to report to DPS?
Colonel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, there is no signage.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Has this particular topic been addressed with the Capitol Security Commission? I know Representative Nash and I just joined on to that, and I don't. We certainly haven't had a meeting to discuss this particular topic about the Capitol complex, or been a part of this before this bill was introduced. Do you know any history with that?
Yes, Representative Schoen. I think we've gone over for at least a couple of years and had meetings specifically about Capitol Security and the carry of handguns, and I can't remember what the commission was called. Maybe one of the testifiers can remember. We had hearings this last year and the year before, I believe, and there was some that wanted to change it and some that didn't. But one thing that was uncovered during the testimony is that there wasn't any problems with permit holders, and everybody seemed to kind of wonder why we had the paper filed if everybody. If they had access to the database, why go through the hassle of the paperwork? But nothing was done at that time to get rid of it. Okay. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, one of the questions I have, look, Gokra is kind enough to put out a map showing the Capitol complex area. And if you actually look at it, a little hard to read, but if you are walking on a street actually two blocks from here, on the west side of the road, you're not in the Capitol Complex area, but if you're on the east side of the road, you are. So basically, if you're walking down the sidewalk, you'd have to notify the commissioner just to walk down the sidewalk. It's two blocks from here, and if you go north, it's 1, 2, 7 blocks north of here. It's part of the Capitol Complex. So it's a large area where if you don't notify, and if people they're thinking they're 7 blocks from the Capitol, they would not even think they're on the Capitol grounds.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for pointing that out. And that's really one of the impetuses for us to bring this forward is, you know, the folks who have undergone the scrutiny and have acquired their permit to carry are willingly submitting themselves and declaring themselves essentially law-abiding folks who just wish to carry under their Second Amendment rights. And this current methodology creates, for lack of a better term, a gotcha moment for them. So they could be on campus somewhere in the Capitol campus, whether they're out for a stroll or they're there to visit the History Center, they could become a felon just by walking down a street. And we feel very strongly that the technological solution with the $1.2 million database that was appropriated by the legislature is a far more comprehensive, straightforward, and fair solution to the notification process.
Okay, Representative Hertaus, and then Representative Hillstrom, and then we'll probably move to. Do you have any, before Representative Hertaus asks a question, do you have any more support testifiers? Or?
No, sir.
Okay, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this forward. I just wanted to follow up also on what Representative Johnson said. When you look at this map, somebody who's legally permitted might check into the Kelly Inn, of all places, and not even think twice to think that they're technically on the Capitol complex. So a tourist from greater Minnesota that has a permit, or even somebody who has reciprocity with our state, could check into the motel or go over to Sears with no intention of even coming to the government buildings and are in violation of the law and potentially subscribe to a felony violation. So thanks for bringing this forward, and we need to fix this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, thank you for pointing that out. And it is a large area, and we want to make sure that we're affording the people who have undergone the scrutiny and have legally been issued a permit to carry are not set up for that gotcha moment that we talked about.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, you were great to say we really need to make sure that we're talking about facts. And so I have been consulting with staff because I noticed Sears was on the map and I wanted to make certain, and the light rail line is on the map, and I wanted to make certain that someone riding the light rail wouldn't be in violation already, or someone in Sears wouldn't be in violation as defined under the Capitol grounds. And after consulting with a nonpartisan staff, and they can answer this if they'd like, but on line 1.13, it reflects current law, and it actually says in any state building. So if you're just on the light rail, you're not in violation of the statute. If you're in Sears, you're not in violation of the statute. It's about going into a public state building. And I just want to make sure that we keep the facts on the record as we go forward, Mr. Chair.
So if we pass this bill, then we clarify it and don't have to worry about boundary lines, because once you get the permit, it will be your notification. Any other questions here? You want to bring up your opposition? Is there people would like to testify in opposition to this change? And Ms. Martin, is there any pronounce it Martins or Martins?
Joan Peterson.
Oh, she's Joan Peterson. Okay, Joan. Welcome. If you would state your name and the organization you represent and begin, ma'am.
Okay. Chair Cornish and members of the committee, my name is Joan Peterson from Protect Minnesota and the Brady Campaign, both working to prevent gun violence. I live in Duluth and drove down here today for this hearing. I know that you all care about public safety, since you do sit on this committee, and you all serve different constituencies. I'm aware of that. Everyone believes in public safety. When it comes to gun issues, though, there appear to be different ideas about how that is achieved. I sit on the side that believes that having loaded guns in public places doesn't make me or those around me safer. I come by this position because of having lost a sister in a domestic shooting. So wanting to keep others safe from devastating gun violence is really important to me. I know that others believe having a gun with them wherever they go will make them safer. A newly released report from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension about Minnesota's conceal and carry law revealed that in 2014 there were zero instances of a gun permit carrier using a gun in a justifiable self-defense shooting. The same was true in the year 2006, 2007, 2008, 2010, and 2011. In other years, I believe there were several cases. In 2014, there were 3 homicides committed by permit holders and a number of other crimes committed. If Capitol Security gets no notification at all, there will be no way of knowing exactly who is carrying around inside of the who's carrying a gun around inside of the Capitol complex. I actually see no reason for anyone to carry a gun here where the people's business is conducted. We can all have reasonable discussions and agree civilly to disagree on some issues. I really see no danger here. There are those, however, who have bad intent, who may disagree with some of your decisions, who could be carrying a gun around here, and we would not know if they are a legal permit holder or not. As we saw in New Hope, people disgruntled about politics can become violent. This is why we should be more vigilant about guns at the Capitol, not less. We should not be allowing loaded guns here at all, except by trained law enforcement and security personnel. I'm sure you believe that something like that could never happen here, just as I believe that one of my loved ones would never be shot and killed. But bad things actually do happen. Why make it easier for bad things to happen if we care about public safety? So I actually am here to urge you to oppose HF 1434. I don't believe we need more gun carriers where school kids come on field trips, lobbyists meet, citizens come for rallies and meetings, and you do your work. This is all about keeping the public safe from unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. And any questions? Any other, what you would like to, from the opposition, anybody, go ahead, sir. Bring your testimony to the table, your name and organization you represent, if you do, and go ahead.
Bill Cross, I live in Plymouth, Minnesota. Don't really represent an organization. I'm here on my own. I generally do support Protect Minnesota, but I'm on my own on this one. I'm a gun owner. I've been a gun owner most of my life. Being a gun owner, you have responsibilities. What I see in the laws that come out of this organization many times seems to be irresponsible. Conceal and carry, I don't agree with it. If you're so afraid to walk in public, why do you need to have a, why are you carrying a gun if you're that afraid? It comes down to fear and intimidation. Responsibility. If you're passing a background check, you're coming out to be a responsible, law-abiding gun owner. Why do you need a gun in a public building that makes laws for or against what you like? As a gun owner myself, I'm disgusted, absolutely disgusted, with the NRA, the gun lobby, and I'll say the mainly extreme gun owners that believe someone is going to get them. And that includes mainly, a lot of times, the government. And one of those examples is Clyde Bundy in Nevada. Someone is coming to get me, and I need to be armed and close to be dangerous to protect myself from an imaginary fear. We don't need guns in a public building where we're making laws about guns and other things that people like or dislike. We have enough discourse here already. Thank you.
What would you, what was your name again?
I'm sorry. Bill Trolls.
Okay. Mr. Troll, what would you say about the instance in Canada where the terrorists ran into the government building and the only way we stopped was whacked by one of the leaders there? What would happen if that person would have been there with a gun?
Well, thank you for bringing up Canada, because Canada has some different laws than the United States does in the way of how it handles guns. My daughter actually lives in Canada. I just visited her up in Vancouver. We were watching the news. And it came up to gun shootings that were going on in the U.S., which seems to be a daily, hourly thing. And she just mentions, you know, we never hear about this in Canada. We don't have this problem in Canada. Very rare. Why do we have this problem here?
And
we have the most. We have the most guns, and we have the most gun violence. Guns don't keep us safer.
And your answer to my question is
what? How often does that happen? How often does somebody with a gun save somebody else with a gun?
Pretty often.
Oh, yeah, not as often. Most countries have this figured out. We haven't yet.
Okay, thank you, sir. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make 2 points with both testifiers. First, I heard that this is the people's business. Our other civil rights, there is no expectation that we check them at the door when we enter this building, such as the freedom of expression or the freedom of assembly, etc. And the Second Amendment is no different than any other. Second, it's not about fear. To exercise our civil liberties is not about fear. It's because it is our God-given right.
And members, I apologize a little bit. I violated my own rule about keeping it to the bill, so in the future I'll just keep it to the bill and what we're addressing here instead of nationwide gun policy. So, Representative Schoen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to address what you addressed there, that we're getting off topic, but on that, since in that discussion, the piece that you bring up was a staff member in Parliament there, and we've increased troopers here at the Capitol, which means we have more armed people, and we're increasing that budget the way it is. And one of the things that we don't talk about, and I've talked about this with Representative Nash, was that as police officers, if I was assigned to this area, one of my main fears is, the folks that have permit to carries they've been pretty good. We don't have any instances of problems so far. My fear is with the person that does come in rogue, and someone that is trying to help is also going to get shot by a police officer because we don't know who they are, and they pull out a gun. And I said that's one of the considerations that need to be thought about. Maybe the average person thinks that, well, I wouldn't do that. But you and I, when we train and when these troopers train in a shoot-or-don't-shoot scenario, it's called stress inoculation, Representative Johnson. You went through it too. The average person can't handle that. They don't train for that. Maybe some folks do. And thank you if you do, because I appreciate it, because that's a big deal. But when we talk about, well, I'm going to be able to respond, the average person really is not going to be able to, because it's going to cause a stress level that we train to bypass that stress level. We react. At that point, law enforcement isn't thinking. Everybody's reacting. So, I mean, that's just one very important piece of this as well, too.
Well, thank you, Representative Schoen. I am a 32-year-retired cop, and I'm not about to turn over responsibility for my own personal safety to a cop. I'm sorry. They can't be everywhere, and I have no problem with the many armed people at the Capitol. And I remember Mr. Samuelson, I think he was a city councilman, standing outside on the Capitol steps. And we were right in front of the House of Representatives, and he came in to voice his displeasure with one of my gun bills. And I said, I told him, what would you do right now if somebody ran in here and started shooting? And his words were one. He said, duck. I choose not to take that option. Representative Nash, you had something to say.
Mr. Chairman, members, I appreciate Representative Schoen's comment, but I want to point out that by the bill that we have before us, you will know. Notification is still being conducted. We've heard that the paper notification is slow, redundant, and doesn't really add anything additional. So while I appreciate your point, notification does happen, and it actually is on hand for you to know were you to be charged with defending and protecting us here, much like the troopers are. So, you know, it has happened, and notification is taken care of in this bill. So it's just being taken to really a much more logical end, because we've already appropriated that $1.2 million database that is quickly accessible. And Representative Schoen, I think you have access to that yourself when you're in your squad car, were you to make an inquiry if someone had a permit to carry. So, you know, I guess I would ask, do you, if you'd yield to a question?
Well, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, you know, are you more comfortable in calling back to dispatch and asking for a paper copy of something or a database?
Well, first off, Mr. Chair, I was addressing Representative Cornish's remarks. your bill is talking about the registration, system here. I think you've demonstrated that if it's difficult, it's difficult. I think my comments are about the policy as a whole. If your bill addresses something that's not working and it makes you feel better, then let's do it. I mean, what's the difference at this point? What you pointed out. I think that maybe the intent was back in the day that if you come on the Capitol grounds, there should have been signs up that should have said, "Hey, just so you know," because we've failed and the legislature has failed to make sure folks that handle the on-site maintenance didn't put up signs to make sure people knew about it. That should have happened. Like, if you enter this building and you're a permit to carry, you need to check in with the Department of Public Safety. And maybe that should have been a daily thing back. If you come on the grounds or in the building, it should have been every time you visit. I don't know if that was their intent back then. But as far as this goes, this we need to continue the conversation about what is safe, because the reality is those folks that come in, we don't allow them in courtrooms, and these rooms here are nearly the same as a courtroom in some instances because of the volatility of the issues that happen here. And so because it's such a political issue and so divisive, we aren't willing to have those conversations and let the troopers and the folks that deal with security here they should be giving us the advice. And then we should be able to react on that and say, yeah, okay, if that's what you need to do to make this place safe, that's fine. In your instance, in this bill, I don't know that anybody is saying that it's safer today or tomorrow either way. So we can move on with this. But we're going back and forth on rhetoric now.
Okay. Doesn't look like there's any more questions. What have you got, anybody else? If not, any public testimony? I think we're done. So Representative Nash will renew his motion. House File 372 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. Thank you much, Representative Nash.
Thank you very much.
Next we have Representative Anderson, House File 1434, suppressors.
Treat your summer.
Thanks. Anybody want to move the suppressor bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1434 to go to the General Registry.
Okay, Representative Howe has moved your bill. Go ahead and begin, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I bring to you House File number 1434 today. Excuse me, I have a cold.
I forgot to have you say your name.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Anderson.
Thank you.
House File 1434 would bring Minnesota into the American mainstream, joining 39 other states that allow possession of sound suppressors on firearms. These devices were invented in 1902 by the same man who invented the automobile muffler, and both were marketed as, quote, silencers. But that name only reflected slick marketing and not science. Despite what you've seen in the movies or heard on the local news, guns or firearm suppressors don't make a gun silent. What they do is reduce the noise from a rifle or a pistol from instantly damaging to just really, really loud. A typical suppressed rifle is about 8 times louder than a jackhammer. Suppressors are, first and foremost, safety devices. Like a seatbelt, they don't completely prevent injury, but they do a lot to reduce the risk and severity. Besides the clear health impact, the sound reduction provided by suppressors have two other key benefits.
One, noise pollution can be reduced. Neighbors, even out in the country, benefit from the reduced noise from shooting activities. And the second benefit, students, instructors, range officers, competitors, and recreational shooters can better hear each other. This is absolutely critical for safety when teaching or participating in group shooting activities. Those who oppose this common sense legislation will tell you, without our state ban, it will be a free-for-all with criminals buying suppressors left and right. That's just not true. Sound suppressors are regulated by the federal government exactly the same strict way that a machine gun is. So no, there won't be a rash of ninja-related shootings. There haven't been in the other 39 states that allow these safety devices, and there won't be here. To talk about some of the technical and legal aspects of suppressors, we have Andrew Rothman, president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. Mr. Chairman.
Oh, sir, go ahead, state your name and begin.
I'm Andrew Rothman. I'm the president of Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. To get a little technical here, because I'm really kind of a nerd about this sort of thing, there are three kinds of noises that a firearm makes when you fire it. There's the click-clack of the action, of the bolt going back and forth, or the slide going back and forth. There's the boom of that gunpowder exploding, and there's the crack, which is the sonic boom of the bullet going faster than the speed of sound. Now, of those three sounds that a firearm makes, a sound suppressor can really only reduce the sound of that boom of the exploding gunpowder. This is a sound suppressor, and unbelievably, this device is treated as a deadly firearm by the federal government, and so it's very tightly regulated. I imagine that this could be deadly if you hit somebody with it hard enough, but it's not really very dangerous by itself. It's an accessory, in the same way that a holster is an accessory, or a sling is an accessory, or a cleaning rod is an accessory. But it is regulated by the federal government. I don't own this one. I'm not allowed to own this in Minnesota, because even though it could save my hearing, it would make me a felon to possess this, because we don't allow that in Minnesota. Fortunately, the legal possessor of this highly dangerous little tube is right here, and so it is legal for me to show it to you right here, because he's still in possession of it. Sound is measured in decibels, and every 10 decibels is a doubling in the apparent level of sound. So a jackhammer tearing up the sidewalk or the street is 110 decibels. Twice as loud as that is 120. Twice as loud as that is 130. Twice as loud as that, or eight times as loud, is 140. 140 decibels, eight times louder than a jackhammer, that's about how loud a suppressed rifle can be. An unsuppressed rifle is about 180 decibels, an unsuppressed pistol about 170 decibels, which means that suppressed pistol, I'm throwing out a lot of numbers here, gets down to about that 140, about that eight times louder than a jackhammer. So although Hiram Maxim was very brilliant in his marketing in calling it a silencer, it's really not accurate, because eight times louder than a jackhammer is anything but silent. These devices are tightly regulated by the federal government. You wouldn't believe how tightly regulated they are. It's just like owning a machine gun. It's a very difficult and expensive and time-consuming process. If we lived in one of the 39 free states that allow the possession of these important safety devices, here's the process that you would follow, and here's the process that we would follow in Minnesota once we get rid of this prohibition that makes no sense. First, I would go to the store where a specially federally licensed dealer can sell these suppressors. They cost $500 or $800 or $1,000. And I'd have to plunk down my money with that dealer, but I wouldn't get to take it home with me. Instead, I would get the serial number, and I'd fill that out on a form. And then I'd take that form, and I'd go to the police department. I'd get fingerprints made. And then I would go to Kinko's and get passport-style photographs taken.
And then I would take all that information and write a check for $200 to the federal government and send that application to the ATF, where they'd take 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months to process it. I'm sorry. One more thing. Before I send in that application, I have to go to my local police chief or sheriff. And I've got to get the local police chief or sheriff to sign off on that form saying, yeah, to the best of my knowledge, Andrew is not prohibited from possessing a firearm or this device in the state. And so there's the first background check. Then I send my $200 and all of this documentation to the federal government, and they sit on it for the better part of a year. They do another background check. And eventually they process that paperwork, and they take a tax stamp, and they affix it to my paperwork, and they would send that back to me. Now that I've got that tax stamp and I've had two background checks, I can go back to the dealer who got my money 9 months ago, and $200 poorer to enrich the federal government. I can take that paperwork, show it to the dealer who, oh wait, he's got to do a background check. There's a third background check at that federally licensed dealer before I am allowed to take that suppressor home. Then it's under very, very tight federal legal control. If I leave that on the table and go to work and my wife is home, she's a felon. I have to keep that suppressor locked up, unavailable to her or to anybody else. I can't loan it to a friend. I can't walk out of the range while someone else is shooting my suppressed gun. I've got to be right there, just like Luke is right there, keeping an eye on that highly dangerous tube of metal. And that's what it is. It's a tube of metal. Inside it has some baffles in it. It works just like an automotive suppressor. Those hot gases come through and they slow down and they cool down as they go through that tube. And so it makes less of a loud boom when it goes through. This is the process that would exist if we got rid of the federal or of the state prohibition on these suppressors. The federal law would still apply in all of its splendid glory.
Okay, thank you, sir. Any other any questions now, or should we move to the next? Representative Quam, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was sort of timely. Someone accidentally bumped the we've got a small elevator here in a room, and it seemed like almost everybody sort of, you know, jumped a little bit. I'm assuming that on a decibel scale, that barely even registers, yet everyone in this room, you know, jumped. So, I don't think that would even show up on a scale you're showing below the lawnmower and et cetera. So I'm glad that the people in the room were able to understand how we can react to a sound like that, and probably would definitely react if we heard a suppressor sound.
Well, unfortunately, you're going to hear from opponents that they make
Mr. Rothman, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. I'm new here. You may hear that these devices make a firearm silent, and obviously that's nothing could be further from the truth. And I don't think that we're going to have a rash of ninja shootings. And in fact, we have the history to show that. Suppressors have always been legal with these federal hoops in some states. They're currently legal in 39 states, so the vast majority of states, they are legal for the people who are willing to pass a background check and have the money and have the patience to wait for it. Now, you can get charged with a federal felony for unlawful possession of a suppressor. You get 10 years, even if you don't do anything bad with it, just for having it. And in fact, if you take a 2-liter soda bottle and you put some packing peanuts in it and you shove that on the end of your barrel, that's a felony. That's 10 years because it's a suppressor. A criminal who would be interested in quieting the sound of a firearm isn't likely to go through that very expensive and time-consuming process when he can do a fairly good job with a soda bottle or with a Fram oil filter from the local auto parts store for $12.
The Representative Dean, I should have probably encouraged him to wait, because after we get a couple more testifiers, it'll probably answer questions that are going to be asked now. But go ahead, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, Mr. Rothman, you just mentioned that if you had gone through the process and you have a silencer and you leave it on your table and your wife is home and you leave, she would be in violation of a felony, correct?
That's correct. It's a federal felony.
And how is that enforced?
Mr. Rothman, and let's try to keep our answers short, too. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, like any other crime, it would have to be caught, and it would have to be prosecuted.
Representative Dean.
So in the same way that there's almost no ability to enforce trigger locks unless there's an accident or an event, there's really no way to enforce that because officers can't come into your house without a search warrant or your permission, correct?
Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, God bless America. The police cannot come into your house and see what felonies you might be committing. I've heard that each of us commits three felonies a day unwittingly.
All right. We, if you've got any other testifiers back yet, Mr. Or Representative Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Next, we'd like to bring up certified firearm safety instructor and federally licensed dealer Luke Soderling.
Welcome, sir. If you would state your name and begin.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Luke Soderling. I'm a permit to carry instructor certified by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension here in Minnesota. I'm also certified by the Bureau of Criminal Identification in Utah. In my classes, I have hundreds of students each year shooting thousands of rounds. I myself, as a competitive shooter, shoot thousands of rounds myself through training and practice as well as competition. I'm here to urge you to repeal the state prohibition against sound suppressors for two main reasons. The first of this, of which I would like to reduce my exposure to muzzle blast-induced hearing loss. It's a real problem that instructors find. The second reason is training in competitive environments are much safer places when range commands don't need to be shouted over hearing protection, such as earmuffs and earplugs. In some cases at the range, my students don't know who I'm talking to, and in order to understand better, they turn towards me to see my lips. This is not a safe thing to be doing on the firearm or on the firing range while holding a loaded firearm. Years ago, I attended the Hibbing Law Enforcement Academy. And during a live fire training exercise, the instructor had to use his foot to get the attention of a student who was shooting in the prone position. This startled them, and they turned, waving a loaded gun at everybody on the firing line and the instructor themselves. As an instructor, I find myself having to carefully place my hand on the shoulder of a shooter to get the attention if they're unable to hear my commands. Not being able to hear and respond to the urgent command is a real safety issue for a range officer and everyone at the range. As a federally licensed Class 3 dealer, I have sound suppressors for demonstration purposes. This is one of them right here. This is a 22 caliber suppressor. It's very small. This would go on a 22 rifle. A larger suppressor would be significantly bigger. When I demonstrate these to people, I hear two things all the time. They say, man, I thought that would be a lot quieter. And the other thing they always say is, why are these things not legal? Like safety goggles, earmuffs, and helmets, suppressors are safety tools. Please restore for me and all Minnesotans the right to protect our hearing and make our ranges as safe as they can be. I want to thank you for your time, consideration. I welcome any questions.
Okay, thank you, sir. And bring up another one, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next I have Mr. Kevin Vick. Mr. Vick is an avid and responsible shooter, and at a moment's malfunction changed his hearing health permanently.
Mr. Vick, if you restate your name and organization and begin, sir.
Yes, sir. Kevin Vick. Excuse me. I am the owner of Crucible Arms out of Lakeville, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for your time this afternoon. This morning yet. As I said, I'm the owner of Crucible Arms. I teach firearm safety and handling courses as a certified instructor. I'm here today to talk about the health benefits associated with the use of suppressors. When I was 8 years old, my father taught me the importance of wearing hearing protection to reduce, however not eliminate, the potential for hearing damage that can occur when target shooting or hunting. Hearing damage among shooting sport enthusiasts is well documented and undisputed. A study of recreational firearm use and hearing loss published by the Archives of Family Medical Journal shows hunters and target shooters experiencing significantly higher levels of hearing loss over time, even when wearing hearing protection, when compared to the general population. Additionally, University of Florida has reported that those that are on certain medications, such as Cialis, sorry, I had to say it, people with conditions such as diabetes, or people who are under chemotherapy, have a significant reaction to the discharge of a firearm and can suffer very significant side effects. Those with no experience with suppressors will have you believe the Hollywood myth of silencing. Independent, validated testing shows suppressors reduce a typical sporting rifle, as has been said, from about 167 decibels to roughly 130 decibels, which is still 35 to 40 times louder than a jackhammer. However, that difference a suppressor makes is enough to eliminate immediate pain and permanent hearing damage. Last December, I was shooting at target practice. I was wearing a popular, high-quality set of hearing earmuff protection. What I didn't realize was that my eye protection caused a slight gap in the seal with the earmuff. I was standing at exactly the right angle in exactly the wrong time when my son discharged his firearm. It permanently damaged my hearing. As this audiology report shows, I have permanent loss of over 50% of my ability to hear normal conversations and have tinnitus, a permanent and constant ringing and distortion of sound in my left ear as a result of a single shot. The use of a legal suppressor would have prevented my hearing loss. My goal today is to help the members of this committee understand the health benefits of allowing the legal use of suppressors, as 39 other states have already done, in reducing irreversible hearing loss among your constituents. I serve as one example out of many who could have and have yet to be helped by the passage of this bill. Thank you, and I'm open for your questions.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. You had mentioned that it was your son's firearm that caused the hearing loss.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, sir.
I'm a representative.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So if he wouldn't have been using a suppressor and you would have actually been the one using a suppressor, you would have still had that affected hearing loss, correct?
Help me understand the question, sir.
Okay, if you were using a suppressor as you were shooting on the range, I'm assuming it was a range, it could have been somewhere else, mm-hmm. and your son did not have a suppressor, the impact to you would have been exactly the same as it is today?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
However, we would both have suppressors in that particular instance.
He answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, you have Mr. Knox Williams. From the American Suppressor Association, come forward and state your name and organization again for the record and begin, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. My name is Knox Williams. I'm the president and executive director of the American Suppressor Association. We are a nonprofit trade association which represents the suppressor industry and suppressor consumers. I think that most of the high points have been hit, so I'm just going to explain a few things that I think need to be reemphasized. Again, suppressors have been regulated on the federal level since 1934. They are regulated under the same act, the National Firearms Act, which regulates suppressors and short-barrel rifles, among other things. There's an extensive process through which to purchase a suppressor, which includes background checks run by both the ATF and the FBI, and additional background checks conducted at the dealership at the point of purchase. 39 states currently allow civilians to own suppressors. Of those, 35 states allow civilians to use them while hunting in the field. To give you a little bit of background on other countries where suppressors are more readily available, the UK, where firearms are heavily restricted, it's very easy to buy a suppressor. In fact, they call suppressors firearm moderators or mufflers. Their term for a car muffler is a silencer, which is just a little inversion on words. But the technology is exactly the same. The science behind a suppressor is you're allowing hot gases, which are expanding rapidly out of the end of a firearm, to expand and cool in a controlled environment. Similar principle to taking a tight balloon and popping it with a needle, you're going to have a loud noise. you take that same balloon and you untie the end of it and let the air out slowly, you will not have that loud pop. Same amount of energy is being dispersed. It's just a matter of how it's being dispersed. In terms of opponents of this legislation, they're going to say that, A, that these suppressors silence firearms, which, again, is not true. Under the best circumstances, firearm suppressors on .22 caliber firearms with subsonic ammunition, which is the quietest set that you can get, it's going to register between 110 to 115 decibels. It's about as loud as a jackhammer. To my knowledge, I've never heard anyone say that a jackhammer is silent, let alone quiet. These things certainly do reduce the noise of a host firearm to much more manageable levels, and in the context of shooting, they make a significant difference. However, again, I think it needs to be continuously emphasized that they do not render a gunshot silent. In terms of their use in crime, I would challenge someone to come up with instances in the 39 states where they're legal saying that this is a significant problem. Where we do see suppressors used in crime, almost exclusively they've been illegally manufactured. Someone who hasn't gone through the federal process, who either duct tapes a 2-liter bottle to the end of their firearm or attaches an oil can or goes to a Lowe's or Home Depot and makes a crude suppressor out of PVC pipe and crush washers. Those are the suppressors that turn up in crime. This bill has nothing to do with that. If they're not properly registered with the ATF, they are still illegal, and this bill would not change that. Criminals also who do use firearms want to be able to conceal them. I'm fairly certain that not many people are going to want to add 4 to 9 inches to the end of their gun, which would hinder their concealability to use these things in the street. Representative Den, to address one of your questions, sir, you asked earlier how these items would be enforced if there was an illegal transfer that occurred. At the home, it's very hard to do so. If you take these out to the range, which most people buy these things to use, and a law enforcement officer sees you using it, if you can't provide documentation through what's called your ATF Form 4, your approved paperwork back from the ATF, then they can arrest you. And it's the burden is on you to prove that this thing is registered to you. So to answer your question, in a home, it would be more difficult. When they're being used, law enforcement can ask for verification that these things are properly registered. To the gentleman who spoke before me, it is certainly worth noting that hearing protection in the form of earmuffs or earplugs is contingent upon their proper seal being attained. With earmuffs, it needs to have a complete seal around the ears. With earplugs, it has to have a deep insertion into your ear canal to be able to block out these high levels of sound. Suppressors diminish the report of a firearm by about 20 to 35 decibels, which is in effect about the same level as common earplugs or earmuffs. Hearing protection, traditional hearing protection devices are also contingent upon everyone around them using them and using them properly. Suppressors diminish the noise of that host firearm for everyone around, not just the person who's actually shooting. My final point, and one that I think is worth noting, is that even though most hunters understand that firearms are loud and that it's dangerous to shoot them without wearing hearing protection, without a suppressor, most hunters still choose to go into the field without hearing protection because they want to be able to hear their environment. They want to be able to maintain what's called auditory situational awareness, to be able to hear the animal that they're spending 4 hours at the crack of dawn in freezing temperatures trying to hunt. And most hunters aren't willing to sacrifice the hunt for the sake of their hearing because they think it's just one shot, it's not really going to make a difference. That could not be further from the truth, especially when you're talking about shotguns or centerfire rifle calibers, which can meter in excess of 180 decibels. Single exposure to that, whether you notice it or not, is going to damage your hearing. Most of the time, people who don't notice that it is, they don't notice it because they've already lost quite a bit of their hearing. And hunters who do have hearing aids and have significant hearing loss oftentimes have a false justification that I've already lost it, it can't get worse. And again, that couldn't be further from the truth. With that, I'd like to open it up to any questions.
Okay, before we get to Representative Hillstrom, on a couple of things that I've checked out. First of all, shot spotters or shot locators. There was some concern expressed about whether it would work on shot locators. I called the sergeant of the Minneapolis Police Department and was told that he believed that it would probably be problematic if it was a 22 with a low volume already to put a suppressor on that to be able to have it work. But he also said that shot locators are difficult to make work with shots fired inside buildings, inside cars, in an environmentally enclosed area. So there's a number of problems already with shot locators. He also said, though, that these shot locators recognize a sound that's been put into the database, so that if you took a suppressor fired weapon, entered that into the database, that it could recognize it. So the contention that shot locators don't work is highly inaccurate. Also, I had some law enforcement concerns expressed, and most of it was because of the unknown. I had my researcher call. Of the 39 states, we called Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Indiana, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, and Connecticut. And it basically, they told us it was a complete non-issue, no reported problems. Now, the problem with some of these is they don't have a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension or a statewide collecting source. Some states don't. Either that or they're harder to get to or get back to us. But nobody reported a problem that I didn't report on this. I mean, of all the ones we called, it was a non-issue. And as far as them being stolen and used in crimes or being used in drive-bys or anything that was brought up, say if somebody had one legally owned in their house and somebody went in and stole it, still the statistics do not bear any problems like that out. If they were ended up in there, so have some been burglarized and stolen, they have not ended up, as far as we know, in a crime that we know of in those states. So there's a lot of fear of the unknown, it seems like, but not any empirical evidence to state that they have been a problem in any state that they're allowed for law enforcement. And, sir, did you have anything to add to that?
Yes, sir, I do. A couple of comments on that point. First off, talking about the shot spotter and the ability to register 22 fire, especially suppressed. 22, subsonic 22, you're generally shooting that projectile at about 900 to 1,000 feet per second, which is in subsonic range. You can go to a Walmart or any store that sells air guns and buy an air gun that's more powerful than a 22. Things that shoot generally 0.177 pellets at about 12 to 1,300 feet per second right off the shelf. So to that point, it's 22, not a powerful round. In addition to that, in terms of public safety, how often are 22s used in crime? My second point, and one that you, of the states that you queried, Florida and Arizona are both in the top five suppressor markets in the country, in terms of the most suppressors in circulation in those states. If they're not seeing a problem with it, who would?
Your Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have some real technical questions about this flyer that you passed out. So I think your testimony was that 39 states allow them and that 35 allow them while hunting. How many allow them for handguns? Do all of them?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The second is, does the length of the suppressor determine the amount of sound that's reduced from the shot of the firearm, or what has that impact, and do any of these states limit the length or the size? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the amount of suppression is contingent upon a host of factors. Different manufacturers have different ways to reduce it. Some will tell you that the length will have an impact. Some will tell you that the diameter will have an impact. Usually speaking, it's the internal volume that you have and the way that you're rerouting both the energy and disrupting the gases from coming out hot. You're basically trying to create an environment where they can slowly cool. No states currently have any laws on the book that would say it has to meet this length or has to be this loud. Suppressors are treated the same across the board in terms of size and scope. Usually, generally speaking, the shorter the suppressor or the less the internal volume, the louder that it will be. There are some manufacturers that put out relatively short suppressors Generally, the trade-off is that it's going to be much louder. I forget the other part of your question. Have an answer for it, but what did I miss? Oh,
you got all of those, but I have another one.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so does putting a suppressor on a firearm have an impact on the bullet? So if law enforcement is attempting to connect a bullet to a crime, does actually putting the suppressor on the end of the firearm require you to have both the gun and the suppressor in order to link it, or does it have no impact?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, it doesn't. Suppressors, the way that they're currently designed, the bullet does not touch the suppressor at all. If the bullet is making contact with the suppressor, then you have an issue. But the diameter with which the bullet will travel through on the suppressor is larger than the bullet itself, and these are specifically designed so that the bullet does not touch them, so that the suppressor does not disrupt the flight. Thus, you wouldn't have any markings from the suppressor on the bullets, and in order to trace a bullet to its host firearm, whether or not it was suppressed would have no impact on that.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple of questions for the testifier. Just so I know who you work for, you had mentioned the National Suppressor Association. How large is the membership?
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's the American Suppressor Association.
I'm sorry.
In terms of manufacturers or in terms of dealers or consumers?
Just in terms of sort of regular folks who are members,
so
your individual membership. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Currently, we represent 62 suppressor dealers nationwide and around 1,000 consumers. We also represent the overwhelming majority of manufacturers.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Dean.
And of your overall budget, what percentages is from dealers or from manufacturers?
Mr. Williams, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently the majority of it is from industry. However, that's largely because it wasn't until this year where we really made a push to expand our dealer network and our consumer network. It's sort of, we're a young organization. We formed in late 2011, and we're standing up trying to expand.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
A couple other questions. And you had mentioned earlier England and the ability to obtain a suppressor in England. Gun laws in England, a lot different from the United States?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, absolutely. It's much harder to purchase a firearm in the UK than it is to get a suppressor.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, last question here. So should we pass this law? Would I, as an individual, be able to go to a gun show and purchase a suppressor along with a gun without having a background check or going through the whole filing process?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely not. In order to purchase a suppressor, you have to go through the federal process with the ATF, which includes submitting the Form 4, paying your transfer tax, waiting for them to approve it before you can get it. Even if you wanted to purchase it from an individual, they would have to transfer it to a dealer, which would require that entire process to take place for them transferring it to the dealer. Then the dealer would have to transfer it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up then. So I would not be able to purchase this at a gun show and walk in and walk out with a suppressor.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. You would have to go through the federal process before you were able to walk out with it.
Okay. Let's see. Any other testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. If there's no more questions at the time, we'll bring up the opposition, and state your name and title and begin, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Weapons Collectors. We had a little snafu. I had their legal counsel on the docket, and he got missed, and he was here, but I didn't see him in the room, so you're stuck with me as its replacement. Minnesota Weapons Collectors is the largest and oldest group of its kind, with a history spanning back over 50 years. The organization represents a large constituency of folks that not only collect but also shoot
whether it be target or sport shooting or hunting. And very briefly, this organization supports the bill as it's written. They think that the use of suppressors and the availability of suppressors would be very important to their clientele as a way to mitigate hearing loss, as you know, on the range or in the field. Hearing loss is an issue with people with firearms. So the organization does support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Sorry to label you as opposition. Now, anybody else in support that we didn't get on the list? Because we just made up a list, but we didn't. Okay, those that, yeah, in the back, in support?
Yes.
Okay. We would just ask that if there's something new to cover from the, that was missed or something, but if you could not, you know, regurgitate the whole testimony as well.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman. First of all, you need my name and who I represent.
You bet.
My name is Nicholas Peterson. I represent myself just here as a citizen of the state. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to cover is I also suffer hearing loss. I was a member of the Minnesota National Guard for 10 years. In 2009, I went to Iraq in support of OIF. During that same year, the Department of Defense paid $1.1 billion because of hearing damages. The military has done a lot to give the proper equipment. However, some situations, even with the proper equipment, hearing loss is inevitable because hearing protection can fail, can fall off, perspiration will break the seal and allow pressure to come in. But one thing that hasn't been addressed is also home defense. You can have a suppressor, and if you're trying to protect your family or your children and you need a discharge weapon because of an intruder, you don't have time to get hearing protection for yourself or your children or your wife. So there's going to be hearing damage for yourself, communication is broken, and you don't know what's going on. You probably have lost your hearing, and your kids or your wife may have lost hearing as well.
Okay, well, I thank you, sir, for your testimony. I appreciate it. Now, would the those who would oppose the bill want to come forward and state your name and organization and begin?
Hi, my name is Heather Martens, and I'm Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. We represent a network of 15,000 Minnesotans who are concerned about gun violence in our state and nation, and we are opposed to this bill. The arguments that we have heard include one argument is that few silencers are used in crimes currently. That's correct, and the reason for that is because silencers are far more strongly regulated than firearms at the federal level. There is a background check required, there is a storage requirement, there's a fee, there's registration, there's fingerprinting, none of which we have for firearms in a comprehensive way. So actually the argument that they're giving that a well-regulated firearm and silencer is a good idea. We should have those kinds of regulations. The problem is that when you dismantle those regulations at the federal level, which the industry is currently working to do with the support of the NRA lobbying arm, then we should be concerned that we still have safeguards at the state level. We do know that the federal government currently and the Congress currently is open to the dismantling of gun laws that keep us safe. We should keep Minnesota's gun laws in place to make sure that we have a way of protecting ourselves if the federal government changes its laws. I would also like to point out that the Chiefs of Police Association is opposed to this bill. I believe they sent you a letter to that effect, and I don't believe that they should be dismissed. I believe they are an important authority on this issue. I believe that they should be regarded with respect. And with regard to the City of Minneapolis ShotSpotters, we understand that the ShotSpotters are not perfect in any way, and we believe that there is no good reason to make it even more difficult for shot spotters to function correctly. Plenty of shootings occur with 22s. We know that. And we, at the Minneapolis level, at the in law enforcement in Minneapolis, can use all the help we can get to apprehend people who are committing shootings. I would like to also point out that silencers are not designed for hearing protection. Silencers were designed to allow people to commit murder and get away with it. I would like to point out that if it takes...
Keep it quiet, please.
That one of the concerns that we have is if there is someone that is committing a mass shooting, if they do have the benefit of a silencer, they can claim more victims before they are caught, and that is a serious concern. We would like to prevent tragedy, not react after the fact. I guess in summation, I would like to point out that firearms are deadly weapons. They're not toys. They're not to be used irresponsibly. We expect firearms owners, and we do support owning firearms by responsible people. There are legitimate reasons to own firearms. However, if you are going to start saying that a silencer is a reasonable accessory to have on every firearm, that's encouraging irresponsible behavior. You do not have to exert as much care at the firing range or out when you're hunting if you can just rely on your silencer to protect your hearing and those of the others around you. We don't support that. And I would like to close my...
Okay, thank you, Ms. Martins?
Martins.
And sorry for the outburst. The before we get to Representative Howe, I just wanted to point out we didn't dismiss the chief's letter. It's in each packet, but I'm certainly not going to bring to the front any opposition. It's in their packets. I'm here in support. But I did have a long talk with the gentleman from the Chiefs of Police Association, and I told him that nothing in his chief of police letter was backed up by any empirical data whatsoever. And, of course, that was just my opinion. And but we did have a good conversation together about the letter, and it's in the packet. So, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned that someone that was going to do a mass killing or multiple shootings would have an advantage. I see in some of our data here that in a study of 10 years of data, they had 12 cases of actually the firearm being fired with a silencer in a committing of a crime. Can you elaborate on any one of those 12 instances where multiple victims were shot with a silencer?
Mr. Chair, this goes back to my original point that, yes, silencers are used very, very rarely right now in crime because they are so strongly regulated. They are, you're subject to a very extensive background check. You are subject to registration, fingerprinting, a fee. All of those things are very difficult for a person of criminal intent or mental instability to pass, and that is why we have such a low level of silencer use in those kinds of crimes right now. However, the federal level regulation is now under attack at the federal level by the industry that we see here and by the NRA lobbying organization.
Representative Hall.
So how does this bill change the federal regulations that so stringently require all that? I guess I fail to see the connection.
Ms. Martins.
The state does not have the authority to change federal law. So, no, it does not change the federal law. What it does is it removes the state safeguard against, if the federal law is not enforced, is under attack right now, we will have nothing at the state level to protect us.
Okay. Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have some language questions on the bill, so if you just let me know when it's the proper time for me to ask those, that would be great.
Okay. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to understand the logic and the testifier when
indicating that someone wishing to kill someone with a suppressor on the weapon could stealthily do that or be non-detectable. Anyone that you know of that has a normal or even reasonable hearing, could they be snuck up on by eight jackhammers?
Ms. Martins.
Mr. Chair, I think what this goes back to is that the federal government regulates these firearms, or regulates silencers to the degree that it's difficult for a person who wishes to commit harm to get them. If you are equating the sound of a shot fired with a silencer to seven jackhammers, is that what you're saying?
Representative Kwan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I used the number eight.
Eight.
Because that would be, I'm a scientist in real life, and therefore I work with facts and science. And when you have a decibel scale, you know, and something's eight times louder, in order to produce that, you know, a normal person would think, well, you'd have about eight of those. And you know, lawnmowers, you would have to have 32 lawnmowers. Maybe you're not as experienced with jackhammers around, but 32 lawnmowers stealthily sneaking up. Maybe that's easier for you to understand, to be able to have somebody not notice.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Martins.
I would say it depends entirely on how far away you are from the source of the noise, and I think that's scientifically backed as well.
Okay, Representative Wellens, do you want to do it now or wait till to see if there's any more opposition?
Why don't you see if there's any more testimony?
Okay, are you done, Ms. Martins?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anybody who would like to testify in opposition? All righty. And remind the crowd to just hold it down. Is there something that you find objectionable? Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Richard Mazur. I'm a retired general surgeon, board certified general surgeon. A little bit about my credentials, if you will, or lack of credentials. I know absolutely nothing about guns. I don't own a gun. And when I was serving in the Air Force as a general surgeon, we rarely used guns. And so that's my lack of knowledge. My credentials might include the fact that my residency was at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. Just as a matter of context, at the time of my training, Kings County Hospital is 10 times larger than Hennepin County Medical Center is today. And in the year that I spent on the trauma service, I had the misfortune of having to see firsthand, literally and figuratively, the effectiveness of gunshots as far as their killing capacity. And I don't know how many people in this room have had the experience that I have had where my hands were inside the abdomen of a living human being who bled to death because I was unable to save his life. And that was not a singular occasion. That was, unfortunately, more than once. So that's my background. On another personal note, I owe a debt of gratitude to Mr. Rothman, who spoke earlier. First of all, Mr. Rothman helped me navigate the parking meter for the visitor's parking lot, which was something that I was unable to do without his help. And then in conversation, Mr. Rothman made me aware of something that I was not aware of. I came here as a general supporter of Protect Minnesota. But what Mr. Rothman made me aware of was the fact that this suppressor issue is apparently a health issue. And I know a little bit about health issues as a physician, and the I want to focus on that specific issue, which I want to insert a little bit of skepticism here. And I insert that skepticism as a physician. My skepticism is that there is a lot of commentary here today that correlates the use of suppressors with improved hearing protection or hearing protection. There may be some sketchy evidence. Mr. Rothman cited some sources. I would, to use the parlance, the jury is out on this, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not an expert on this, but generally speaking, as a physician, I can say that many of the so-called scientific facts of our world as doctors have subsequently been shown to be totally false. And these are, quote, scientific facts, unquote, that were researched meticulously and met all the standards of research, and subsequently, as I said, were shown to be totally false. So my only purpose is to say, in summary, that it sounds logical to say that if you reduce decibel levels by using suppressors, that you will actually protect hearing. As logical as that sounds, until the outcome is clearly shown to be the case, I, for one, would be skeptical, and as a physician, I would advise all non-physicians to have that same skepticism. And I'll be glad to field any questions or comments that anybody has to make.
Okay, Representative Quam, keep in mind we got 12 minutes left and a couple testifiers left. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would staff be able to tell us approximately how many statutes have decibel levels for health and safety and where equipment's required? I assume that there are some, so we understand just how the state and courts treat decibel levels.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, unfortunately, I have no idea. I don't deal in OSHA or other regulations on public safety, so I'm not aware of those in the criminal statute.
But we do get your point. Okay, thank you, sir. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dean had a question for you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you come back quick? So earlier we heard testimony that a suppressor would reduce the sound on the gun from 167 decibels to 132 decibels. And we've heard a lot of testimony on 132 decibels is, you know, the sound of a jackhammer. So when I'm thinking about the issue of health and hearing loss, I mean, I'm assuming that there's an aggregate that really has an impact. And since you're a doctor, I'll ask you. So I mean, if it's a type of thing that we're suppressing it a little bit, if the aggregate still is fairly large, I'm assuming that it's still going to impact hearing with some hearing loss.
And then while you answer that, what kind of a doctor are you, if you could answer?
Pretty good one.
A what one?
My boards are in general surgery, and
okay.
and with all due respect, I'm not qualified to answer that. I'm simply, my point today is simply to introduce a certain amount of doubt here as to the validity. It sounds logical that if you put a suppressor on a gun, that it's going to protect hearing. It sounds very logical. All I'm saying is that the history of medicine is replete with similar logical formulations that turned out, because the human body doesn't follow logical courses, turned out to be totally false. That's my message.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you. And ma'am, if you could state your name and organization again, and go ahead. And if you could, we're not going to cut you off, but if you could keep it as short as possible.
Right. Again, my name is Joan Peterson. I'm here from Protect Minnesota and the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. I was just listening to the prior testimony, and I had some some questions and concerns. The first one is, why did the federal government determine that suppressors needed the kind of regulations they needed in the first place? And I think we all know the answer to that. I think we can look back to the days of Elliot Ness and the mafia and all of those things that we associate with suppressors. So there are and were reasons why suppressors are under subject to the federal regulations that they are subject to, and I think we need to think about that when you're reviewing your reasons for passing this. In preparation for coming here today, I asked probably half a dozen or so hunter friends of mine, including my husband, who happens to be a hunter and a gun owner, and also happens to be a physician, about the need for suppressors for hunting, and they all gave me the same look. What? Why? None of them thought a suppressor was a good idea. None of them could see a reason for a suppressor for hunting. And I don't believe you have a bevy of physicians here lining up to tell you about the health risks of hunting and or the health benefits of suppressors. I suggest that you might want to get that. I think that would be very important. I don't believe anybody, aside from the gentleman who just came here, has been asked to testify about the benefits of suppressors on firearms, and I think that would be a good idea for you to find out. I am a former speech-language pathologist. I've worked with children with hearing loss. People lose their hearing for many reasons. This might be one of them, but they do lose their hearing for many reasons. And your question was a good one, the representative who asked about public safety and decibel levels. What else are we protecting people from? 100 decibels is loud. I know that from having worked with kids who have hearing loss. 100 decibels is loud. We are going from 200 to 140, supposedly. I guess that's still loud. And I actually do know people who have lost their hearings from gunshots. So I understand that it's a problem. I'm just not sure that this is the solution to the problem. And I would also like to point out to you that one of the reasons you're here today hearing about this is not because there has been a hue and cry from a lot of people to have suppressors on guns. It is because the gun industry wants this. The suppressor industry wants this. At one time, the NRA didn't even want the suppressor group with them because they knew that suppressors made guns look really bad. They've changed their minds. There's profit here when people go to buy suppressors now. You heard that they're going to cost $500 to $1,000. There's profit to be made. I suggest you think about that. And if you think this is about hunting, I also suggest I happen to look up the ads from the silencer companies. And if you think this or this or this or this looks like a hunter needing a suppressor, then I ask you to consider what you're doing here today. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Next. Looks like we aren't going to get done today. We'll probably quit promptly at noon and then come back at immediately after session.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Kathy Pernew, and I'm here with Protect Minnesota. I did not intend to speak today, and I'll keep it short and sweet. I oppose this as an ordinary voter in the state of Minnesota. I happen to agree with the police officers who suggest that silencers could render ineffective the shot spotters that are in use around the city of Minneapolis. I live in the city of Minneapolis. Someone spoke earlier about people who have a negative reaction to the sound of a gunshot. I have a negative reaction to the sound of a gunshot. Somebody shot out a window in my house a few years ago. So, no, I don't want anything to change a law that would make it easier for people to avoid being detected by the shot spotters. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then on the police, once again, you said police officers in plural. That was the chiefs of police that sent that letter, and you don't see the Sheriff's Association or the MPPOA here today. So, all right, next. Welcome, ma'am. State your name and organization and begin.
Hi, my name is Kyla Cromer, and I have a T-shirt from Protect Minnesota, but I paid $25 for it. I don't represent them in any way. So I'm here as a mom and a citizen and a neighbor, and I want to point out that the lack of empirical evidence that you just mentioned is similar to the lack of empirical evidence that you received talking on the phone when you were asking about the shot spotters. Because something doesn't work perfectly does not mean you abandon it and just continue to erode its efficacy. But what I'd really like to say is that my best friend's brother was shot in his bed at 15 years old in West Bloomington many years ago. And I live very near to Accent Signage, where there was a mass shooting or multiple shooting in Bryn Mawr, Minneapolis. I found out later that my daughter's doctor was the daughter of the fellow that owned that business. So they were at work, obviously. My brother's work was assaulted by a gunman, and he had to climb out a window to get away. And so my main point is that although we obviously need to consider any number of kinds of equipment for our military and for our police officers to keep them safe, people who are hunting or who are on the gun range for sport are engaging purposely and of their choice in potentially risky behavior. Now, my best friend's brother was sleeping in his bed. My brother and the people at Accent Signage were at work. So is it more important to protect the rights of people who choose to participate in risky behaviors or people endanger the public health of people who are sleeping in their homes or they're just going about their day at work?
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Anything else?
No, I just wanted to reframe it that way because nothing I've heard has really come around to that. So thank
okay,
you
thank you
very much.
Sir, we got about 3-4 minutes left, and then we'll recess until tonight. You want to testify now? You might as well get all the opposition in here, and then tonight we'll just have more discussion and questions by members. Go ahead, sir.
Well, my name is Larry Parks. I live in Plymouth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm a member of Protect Minnesota. I'm also active in the movement of building safer communities through sensible gun laws. I'm speaking as an individual, but many of us that support these sensible gun laws are very respectful of gun owners, shooters, collectors, hunters, and so on. We're also, I particularly am very respectful of the Second Amendment and the rights that provides for. And I respect the right of people to carry concealed weapons if that's their choice. I'd like to suggest that for this House File 1434, that the wording should be more restrictive if the committee and the Minnesota legislature wishes to pass this. I would like to see a restriction that these suppressors, as they've been discussed, would be permitted only on gun ranges. I could appreciate the need for reducing the noise, and I will try to speak more loudly so those affected by gun noise can hear my comments, but I would like to see the restriction of the suppressors only for gun ranges. I'd also like to see a restriction on the level of noise reduction that a suppressor is permitted to have in the state of Minnesota. You know, as we all know, that technology innovations in every field, including guns and gun accessories, continues at a rapid pace. So let me ask you, would you be supportive of this bill if the suppressors reduced the noise below, let's say, 70 decibels? I mean, the information that was provided showed the suppressor generally reduced the noise a little bit higher than a jackhammer. But what if it was suppressed, so it would be closer to a silencer type of thing for the stealth type of shooting? Would you still support that? So I would like to see wording in the legislation to limit the noise reduction from a suppressor to not less than 110 decibels, which is the jackhammer level of noise. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. One more, and then we'll wrap up the... and then I think when we come back tonight, we'll... I'd like it if you would pick one person from each side for rebuttal tonight. We'll give you a couple of minutes apiece, and just one person each. We'll close the public testimony after this gentleman here. Go ahead.
Hello, Bill Cross again, Plymouth, Minnesota. I'm a gun owner and a past very active hunter. I own guns for hunting. I don't own them for defending myself from imaginary enemies that are coming to get me, and for the extreme, this would include our government. The way we handle guns in this country is completely irresponsible. When a child can get a hold of a parent's gun and kill their little brother or sister, we should see that we are doing something wrong. When a two-year-old can take their mother's gun from her purse and kill her in a Walmart, we should see that we are doing something wrong. When a child at a gun range kills the instructor with a fully auto Uzi because of the recoil, we should see that we are doing something wrong. The gun lobby believes the answer to our problems with how poorly we handle guns in this is more guns. If we are in a flood, the last thing we need is more water. We have become very irresponsible and plain stupid how we handle guns in this country. Now the gun lobby is marketing to our elected leaders, our gun suppressors, just what we need. Let's do our damage with less noise. It won't attract as much attention. As a gun owner, I see this as an attempt to open up Minnesota as a market for the manufacturers of suppressors. This is all about making money and not caring about the damage it can do in an already gun-crazed society. Follow the money. Every testifier up here but one had a monetary value for their testimony in favor of this. Every one of them except one. This is not about hearing loss. That's an excuse. They already testified that it's loud even with the suppressor. So then they argue that, well, we won't need to wear hearing protection, but it's still loud. So what is it? Is it not loud? Is it loud? I fired many guns. With a suppressor or not, I haven't done it with a suppressor, but they're loud. As a hunter, I see this as an easy way for hunters and mainly poachers to take game illegally and not have the noise to attract attention. When I'm a hunter, I want to know the other activity, shooting, that is going on around me. And also about the comment about the suppressors available in Britain. As anybody knows, I think Britain has some rather different laws regarding firearms than our country. Actually, most countries have vastly different laws about firearms than we do, including Canada, which has some common sense in the way of how they handle firearms and their accessories. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Can you wait till tonight?
Can I?
Okay, you got 30 seconds.
Okay, thanks.
29, 28.
My name is Josh Fralick, and I thank you for the couple of seconds that you're giving me before lunch here. I do not oppose this, and I do not have any financial stake in the suppressor or firearm industry. I happen to manage a technology firm, and I have a passion for firearms. With that passion, I have children that I'm engaging at an appropriate age into firearms and in their use, and suppressors seem common sense to me. I don't want to expose my children to any unnecessary risk, while at the same time sharing my passions with them. Again, no monetary stake. This is not my business. This is my passion. This is something that I get excited about. And so I want to protect my children. I want to protect the people that I shoot with, and I want to protect my hearing. And I'm willing to, as a gun owner, go through all the necessary NFA steps, government, federal steps to make this work. So I had 30 seconds. I took it.
I thank you very much. Appreciate it. Members, if it's okay with you folks, we'll have to come back 15 minutes after session in this room where we will have more discussion and questions as long as you would like, and then vote on the bill, and we'll have opposition and support. Oh, Representative Considine, go ahead. Yeah, I'll give a rebuttal. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all agree that the most compelling argument for suppressors is hearing loss. And yet the one doctor that we heard testify today cast some doubt on it. I'd like to move we table this until we can hear from an audiologist as to whether it's going to help or not. I'm moving to table it until we can hear from an audiologist or some medical professional that can tell us for sure exactly how beneficial it will be.
Actually, we're in recess. Okay, we're bringing the meeting back to order.
Yeah.
And did we have a motion on the table?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw the motion, but I would still like to see something from the medical community that's going to help, if that's possible, before it gets to the floor.
We'll make an attempt.
I may have something legal on that. If
well, he was looking to hear from an audiologist, I think. So.
I have something legal on that.
We'll just wait, I think, and hit it before the floor. All right. Now, we did have some technical questions first before we get into the rebuttal. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, I did have a conversation with Mr. Rothman about some ands versus some ors. So if he wants to identify, I think we need to make a correction in lines 3.14 to 3.23. So, Mr. Rothman, if you want to help me identify which ones should be and versus or, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, there's a typo in the drafting, and as a result on 3.21, there's an or that should be an and. As it currently stands, it would make it far too easy for an appellant to collect legal fees from a sheriff. It was intended to show that the person appealing the denial had to come up clean three different ways. And so it should be an and. He's clean this way, that way, and the other way.
So Mr. Chair, so on line 3.21, I would make a motion to delete the or and instead insert the word and, A-N-D. And he's okay with it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Diebel, you got the thing recorded? Okay, you all heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I have two questions actually on the language. So on line 3.4, it actually starts on line 3.3. It says, a person who possesses a valid carry permit is presumed to be qualified to receive the certification. So, Mr. Chair, my question for the presenters is, what exactly does that exempt them from? Is it exempting them from a background check? Is it exempting them from an application? What is that? What's the real-life implication of that sentence?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, what this is basically demonstrating is that when a person does get a permit to carry, they do a background check with the local sheriff's office. And what this provision would provide is, we have to go through the whole procedure here. If you get a permit, that's a background check. Now, if you wanted to do a suppressor permit, you'd have to do another background check with the local entities, and then you'd have to do another one with the ATF, and then it comes back to the local entity. So that's four. All this is going to do is say that the first one that you've done for your carry qualifies as one background check. So instead of doing four, you're down to three.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you explain to me how frequently on your carry that background check is redone, so in case something happens from the time that you get that original carry permit to the time that then you might wait and get a suppressor to see if anything has happened in between?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, when you get a permit to carry, The background check is done annually upon certification.
All right.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I want to take you down to lines 3.14 to 3.23. That's the section that we just amended. I'm curious as to, other than the permit to carry statute, is there any place else in law where we say the court must review and the standard by which they may review it? In this case, it says de novo, and then it lays out that the attorney's fees must be paid. I know that this is replicated after the permit to carry statute, but my question is there anywhere else in statute that we give this degree of detail to the court about what they must do on the review?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, not that I know of. I mean, it could be there, but I understand that it's a cause of pre-existing behaviors.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please explain what you meant by that? Whose pre-existing behaviors are we talking about here? And I'm just trying to get a sense why we are giving that much specificity to the court about what they must do and the conclusion they must come to.
Mr. Rothman. Or a representative, either one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, when the carry law passed in 2003, it passed in large part because of a pattern of abuse by the chief law enforcement officers around Minnesota that, for reasons not related to need but related to politics, these chief law enforcement officers were not issuing permits to carry. And it didn't have to do with an objective need, but with a subjective opinion about the law itself. We have seen throughout the country that people are completely stopped from exercising this right to possess one of these NFA items, like a suppressor, because for political reasons, a chief or a sheriff refuses to provide the signature, which is required to process the federal form. It's not supposed to be optional. It's supposed to be them doing their duty. And if they have a good reason for a denial, just like with a carry permit, they should deny it, and the applicant who comes to the court will find that he's paid his attorney $2,000 or $3,000 to lose an appeal because it was justified. If, however, the denial is capricious or without cause, then that behavior needs to be disincentivized by making sure that it will always result in that capricious behavior resulting in a financial penalty to the capricious official.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the reason why I ask is because there's all sorts of times when I've tried to put in statute that somebody's got to pay someone else's attorney's fees, and no offense, but I can never get that to pass. And so it just strikes me as interesting that there's only two places in statute that I know of that it exists. It'll be here, and it'll be in the permit to carry section. So hopefully I'll be able to successfully add this to a couple of other areas that I'm interested in adding it to.
Representative Dean, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, or maybe to the legal folks here. So if I'm a sheriff or the chief enforcement officer, and I, you know, do the check and determine and use my best judgment that this individual should be denied. I'm not doing anything political. I'm not doing anything capricious. I'm not doing anything that has any malice. And I go through the process of a court, and although I was acting in good judgment, would I still be susceptible to having then paying the court fees and attorney's fees for the applicant who was appealing what I had originally submitted or denied as far as certification?
Mr. Rothman, would it be accurate to say that that's the way it is in the permit to carry? I mean, if they think they're using good judgment, but the judge rules that they weren't using good judgment, yes, they would have to pay, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. In the carry permit law, there is discretion where a sheriff can show specific good cause, which doesn't rise to the level of a mechanical denial, a good cause for which, in the totality of circumstances, the permit applicant should be denied a permit to carry. However, that's not the case with the chief law enforcement officer's sign-off in the federal law. There's no discretion involved in that decision. It's saying, is this person a felon or not? Is this person under indictment or not? The chief law enforcement officer doesn't get to make a judgment call on whether this person should be denied. It's a very mechanical process for which there can only be one answer.
So the long and the short of it is that if the sheriff has got some skin in the game, rather than just refusing somebody on a whim now under the law, they would know that if they're wrong, they're going to have to pay, and that'll make them be a little more judicious in their contemplation of that permit.
Mr. Chair, it also It also might make them reluctant to issue a denial where one may be due because the risks and exposure they're putting themselves as well as their county or their city at.
I agree.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Short answer, go ahead.
Again, it's a mechanical process. There's no judgment involved. There are no two answers possible. And so there's no jeopardy. There's exactly one answer. Is the person under indictment, yes or no? Is the person a felon, yes or no? Has the person been convicted of a domestic assault, yes or no? There's no discretion. There's really no risk as long as the chief law enforcement officer is acting in good faith. The chief law enforcement officer is also, I believe, exempt from liability for properly granting this permit to someone who later does something bad. Not that we see that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Filstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up. Has anyone been tracking whether or not anybody's sued under this provision under the concealed carry and if anybody's been paid? Does anyone keep track of that?
What was the question again? I couldn't hear you.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if anybody tracks if under the concealed carry permit if any of these lawsuits have happened and if any local communities have had to pay attorney's fees on any of these.
Mr. Rothman, go ahead, but I believe they have, and in fact, in my county alone, I know there's been a couple of people turned down for permits on the sheriff's. They agreed with the sheriff. It's gone both ways, but I think there has been lawsuits where they've collected money also. Mr. Rothman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, that is correct. In fact, the annual reports from the sheriffs to the BCA require them to say how many denials, how many appeals, and what the outcome of those appeals are. The data is not perfect in that it doesn't distinguish between an administrative appeal, which is simple from the applicant back to the sheriff and may result in a change of mind, and appeals which go to a district court and result in a court decision and the ordering of attorney's fees. However, we did look in detail at the county that by far denies more permits than all the rest, that's Ramsey County, and the number of permit denials that is overturned is roughly half in Ramsey County. So that is for 2013, not 2014. About half of the time, the judge found that the judgment of the sheriff was incorrect and issued the permits. Of course, the other 50% of the time, the judge agreed with the sheriff. And so that's the system working as it ought.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know how many that was? Just a number or where I can find that number?
I can get you that number. It's also in the BCA report. I don't have it handy. I believe it's on the order of high two digits.
Okay. Members, now we're done with the question and answer for now. We'll have another one at the end. But what we were planning on doing is giving a rebuttal. We're going to have the Gun Owner Civil Rights Alliance, Mr. Rothman, start out with 2 minutes, and then Mr. Knox Williams for 2 minutes, and then Heather Martins will have four if she likes, or she can split up between her and another supporter with two each. But we can only give 4 minutes for each side. So, Mr. Rothman, why don't you begin your 2 minutes?
All right. There was some facts, Mr. Chairman, or there are some allegations presented in the testimony that are somewhat without basis. The allegation was that suppressors were designed to allow people to commit murder. I take great offense at that as someone who's interested in getting one of these devices, but we can actually look to contemporaneous advertising from the Maxim Company and see exactly what the purpose of these was and what they were advertised for. Shoot without disturbing someone. Get up a club and have the fun. Avoid disturbance. Avoid flinching. Enjoy quiet shooting. Shoot indoors. Shoot quietly. Makes a great Christmas gift. It's not just good for you, it's good for Kitty. Get it as a Christmas gift for your husband. It'll make him a better shot. It'll let him enjoy many more opportunities to practice. It's a civilizing tool. This is the contemporaneous advertising. It's over 100 years old, and I think it's delightful. The surgeon, my parking lot pal, said that scientific facts have been refuted. This word facts, I think we might have to disagree on the meaning of that word. And let's just remember that gravity is just a theory. We do have some facts. Louder noise causes more damage to our ears. Quieter noise causes less damage to our ears. It seems logical because it is logical, and we have 80 years of medical research to back that up. In fact, Minnesota law specifies that the Pollution Control Agency shall adopt standards as to levels of noise. And in the Minnesota rules, those are based on decibel meters. And so this is already set in law. Decibels are about disturbance. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration explains that the duration of the noise at a certain decibel level results in damage after a certain period of time. And so mowing the lawn, you can't do more than 8 hours at 90 decibels without doing some damage to your hearing in a year, in a day. Jackhammer, more than 15 minutes without hearing protection, you're going to do some damage. Firecracker, your very first time that explodes by your ear, you will have damage. We know that louder noise means more damage, and quieter noise means less damage. It was alleged that suppressors would make shooters more careless. Again, that's pretty offensive and not borne out by facts. It is much safer to shoot when you can hear the other people on the range and they can hear you. The idea was that it's a good idea to leave a complete prohibition in Minnesota just in case the National Firearms Act is repealed. I have to say I'm not terribly worried about that happening anytime soon. It was alleged that we shouldn't throw the shot spotter away because it's not perfect.
Wrap her up.
That's exactly what the city of Oakland in California did. They threw it away because they weren't getting any benefit from it. But it doesn't matter because 0.005% of federal prosecutions for murder involve the use of a suppressor. Almost none.
Okay. We better be done.
All right.
All right. I get your point. Now, Mr. Knox Williams, come up for a couple minutes and...
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for letting me come back and offer a rebuttal. There were several points that I want to hit in regards to questions that were asked and other testimony. First off, again, to reiterate, suppressors were designed at the turn of the 20th century by a gentleman named Hiram Percy Maxim. His father, Hiram Stevens Maxim, if you're a fan of history, invented the machine gun. These were designed, as was illustrated in this presentation, to make shooting more polite and quieter and a little safer. One of his best customers was actually Teddy Roosevelt, who hunted at his estate in Long Island and used suppressors because he didn't want to disturb his neighbors, the Tippetans, who lived at the next door estate. Just a little bit of historical tidbit to add for that. Another thing to consider, guns and firearms have been around for hundreds of years. If firearms were invented today, OSHA would almost certainly mandate the suppressors be used on every firearm to reduce the noise signature. That's certainly not something that we're pushing for, but we feel that law-abiding citizens should have the option to use them to help protect their hearing. In terms of decibel levels and exposure levels and how that pertains to hearing conservation, OSHA defines hearing safe based on a trade-off between exposure time and sound levels. Hearing safe, as defined by OSHA, kicks in at 85 decibels. You can expose yourself safely without hearing protection for up to 8 hours. Decibels are logarithmic in nature. Every 3 decibels that you increase, you're doubling the sound level, which means that you have to cut your exposure time in half. Thus, for 88 decibels, you're at 4 hours. For 91 decibels, you're at 2, and up and up and up until you hit about the 140 decibel threshold, which is considered by OSHA as the hearing safe delineation for an impulse noise. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not that's a legitimate line to consider, but that's more or less the standard as it's perceived within the medical community now. Given that suppressors reduce the overall sound signature of a host firearm by about 20 to 35 decibels, depending on a host of factors, which is comparable to earplugs and earmuffs, I think it's very hard to say that they don't have a tangible health benefit. And it would be no different than saying that wearing earplugs or earmuffs while shooting, science doesn't say that that helps protect you, which is not an argument that I think anyone would make. I think that I've probably used up all of my time, but okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Martins, you may use 4 minutes yourself or a little over or divide it up if you'd like. And then we'll have questions answered from the members and then vote.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and respond to a couple of things. There's actually a major thing that I missed in this bill, and this actually is very important to consider under, and really I suspect that this really isn't about silencers. It's about nullifying the background check requirement for the conceal and carry permit. What you have done here, which I missed, is on line 2.25, you've cut in half the amount of time that law enforcement is allowed to do background checks. This, to me, is actually rather key, because basically if our law enforcement only has 15 days instead of 30 days, as it currently does, you have essentially nullified the background check requirement. I would just like to raise that. I think that should be addressed. I hope that's not the intent. That's very alarming to me. And I did miss it. I appreciate the person who pointed that out. Now, as far as silencers go, you know, there's no evidence that they are a useful hearing protection device. You still would have to use ear protection. And I would also like to point out that, as was mentioned earlier, the proponents of this bill say, don't worry, that federal law will still be there to regulate suppressors and silencers, but your vote in this body will be used as an argument to repeal that very federal law that you are citing. So for these two reasons, the, I believe, unintentional nullification of our background check requirements and the lack of any merit of the argument that silencers are a health device, I urge you to table this until these issues can be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martins. Okay. Questions and answers. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just asking nonpartisan staff to just look up this section of the statute with this new issue that's raised. So I just would like you to give me a few minutes and do whatever else you're going to do, but let me actually read that
no
section
problem.
Of statute.
Mr. Rothman, while they're coming up, do you have any comment about just the answer to the question about what was presented?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. There are three separate deadlines here. The deadline for a permit to carry is 30 days. The sheriff is allowed to do a great deal of background checking and to use his judgment and to look for non-criminal activity, including police calls that don't result in charges or convictions. On the other hand, the purchase permit under 624.7131 has a 7-day turnaround. And the reason for that is because there's no discretion involved. This is simply looking to see whether someone's a criminal or not, and that 7 days is probably 6.5 days too long. This bill refers to the chief law enforcement sign-off for the purpose of a particular class of federally regulated items. And this bill would have absolutely no impact on the permit to purchase, and it would have absolutely no impact on the permit to carry. There are three separate deadlines for three separate processes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rothman. Any other questions so far of Representative Lucero, while Representative Hillstrom is researching here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was just a quick comment, but Mr. Rothman, I think, just answered it. I was going to mention that, so I do property management and rentals, and I frequently engage in background by sending the information for lookups, and the turnaround time is typically by the next day. It's a very quick turnaround time, so 15 days, 7 days, more than enough time.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Lucero, when folks come into a law enforcement agency and they have to look up that information, sometimes there are things that show up from other states that take time to get. And the other issue that we have there is that the you shall issue has caused a problem in Minnesota with agencies that can't get information, say, from Ohio or Indiana, and we never are able to find out in enough time to deny that. So, I mean, one of the things that I would recommend if seven days is the number, then seven. If it's 30, then it's 30, whichever one works, but at least it would be standard. I mean, in comparison, either 30 days or seven.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to that point Representative Schoen makes, I mean, not all states report accurately into the NICS system. And so when we do background checks that include other states, some of the other states, the information we're getting is very minimal. So there does create this opportunity for error to occur with an individual. And when we do begin to shorten that time, it does impinge law enforcement's ability to get the information they need to make the decision that ultimately has been said is it's neither yes or no, but if you can't get that information for that yes or no, it's really, really difficult for folks to make a decision for those enforcement officers. And I'll save my comments, general comments, for later. Thank you.
Many of us wish we lived in a state where you didn't have to go through all this to get a permit, and many states where you don't have quicker turnarounds and constitutional carry. They punch your name into a telephone. If it come back that you're a law-abiding citizen, you don't have to pay to get a permit, but maybe someday in the future we'll be so lucky. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, after a consultation and looking at where it's drafted, clearly right now, based on the structure, it probably, if I were drafting it, wouldn't have drafted it quite this way. I think that right now it appears as if this is different, and it would not deal with the permit to carry issue. However, in the event, you know, there was a change in federal law, this, because you call it certain firearms, it could apply to other things later on. So, Mr. Chair, so while I wouldn't have necessarily put it there, I believe that as it's drafted right now, it doesn't impact the permit to carry piece. My question is, why not just 30 days is really my question, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, we have to go back to the initial process of how even you can even apply to these. This 15-day waiting period is just the initial upfront. You still have to go through the ATF background check, which takes 6 to 9 months. 15 days is really nothing when you're adding on that. After that process, it comes back to the local law enforcement. You still have to do a third background check. Is that enough? And how many days should that take? The feds already have it defined for us.
Well, thanks for clarifying for that. I had even forgotten about that. This sign-off is after you go through the whole other rigmarole of 6 to 8 months or whatever it takes. So, Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, and I on that piece, I understand it's the 6 to 9 months. I'm looking at it from an administrative standpoint. This isn't cops doing this most of the time. It's our administrative staff, and typically somebody's assigned to it. I'm just looking to streamline when they're at the office. I'm likely going to support this bill today. On that number, I'll just make it 30 so that it's streamlined across the board. I mean, if it's 30 days outside of 6 to 8 months, what's 15 more days on this, just so that our staff at the office don't have the same issues? So, I mean, if you would take that as a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair, let's just make it 30 days and be done with it. So it's streamlined and it's consistent through all the other things that we have to deal with, and I don't see it being too problematic.
I'd rather not. It's typical. We don't do substantive amendments, which that really would be.
Because 50 days is substantive?
I would much rather go to 3 days for everything, but I don't think that would pass. Representative Anderson, anybody else have any questions? I think we're good to go here.
Representative or Chairman Cornish, it's been brought to my attention that the this is basically just a mechanical check. And if we were to actually follow what is current state law, we would go the opposite direction, we would amend this instead of 30, this would be 7.
It's not a bad idea, Representative Schoen, but just I don't want to do it here. I make a major right. change like that and consolidate everything.
Mr. Chair, I just bring that up just for argument's sake. And 15 days to us seems very reasonable.
Okay, questions from members. This is the last round of questions and answers, member. Then we're going to vote, so go ahead. Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, so would this be my opportunity for comments?
You bet.
Okay. So
it doesn't have to be a question. You can comment.
No. So we've had lots of different testimony, and quite frankly, some of the stuff is very shocking to me. The piece here from the GOCRA shows what happens with the 0.308 rifle in a 9mm pistol. When you put a suppressor on, it only reduces it to the point that there's still instant damage. So the reduction that we're talking about isn't going to resolve the issue that much of the conversation has been about, and that's about protecting hearing and those types of things. So I'm citing your document that says that the range which would be reduced to still causes instant damage. So I just want to make that clear that you handed out a document that I would say is counter to the argument. You know, gravity is a theory that I think we all have kind of accepted in practice. I think if I rolled my pencil off the table, it would hit the ground. And I saw in the rebuttal and summations that suppressors actually make guns safer, which to me is a little bit confusing how it would make a gun safer unless it's being safer for the issue of hearing, which I just found a contradiction. And I was surprised earlier when Mr. Soderling, who testified as an instructor, about some of the difficulties within a shooting range when he's instructing people, when people turn with their guns, and he clearly states, this is not a safe situation. So I just get troubled when we hear things about issues around safety with, quite frankly, what are lethal weapons. Not all the time do they kill individuals or animals, but quite often, you know, the intent of a rifle is to kill, unless it's at target practice, which is trying to, I would say, and I think you would agree, is the hope that it's going to make you a better marksman. And that's why you go to a range. But not always the case. There are some things and some people that practice and practice and practice and never get better. So I have some great concerns and some great concerns around the issue of the quickness of background checks just because of the inaccuracy of the NICS system. And if we're just doing background checks for people and their records in Minnesota, there's some good reason to consider that. But with larger states involved in this process, I'm very troubled. And one last comment. As I look through this, I appreciate some of the federal guidelines and some of the requirements that are necessary in order to purchase and use a suppressor. And I would love it if we would adopt this bill for all firearms. And I'll end with that.
Okay. Members, if there's no more questions. All right, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess Representative Anderson or whoever wants to answer this, it's more of a question. On the range, currently, obviously, you use head ear protection. Using a suppressor, would you still use that protection or no?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, never having used one personally, I can't answer that, but I would imagine that even people that are using suppressors would still do it because it's still only just a muffler. It's only reducing the noise volume.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rothwell.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. You know, there is something called personal responsibility, and we all do certain things, motorcycles, you name it. We choose to do things that are fun, but sometimes risky. And you know, I'm not necessarily one way or another on this bill, but it doesn't seem to really do anything to help health, as you say, because you're still going to need to use earplugs or headgear or whatever. My concern is I have a little place in the woods, and I like to hear the loudest bang possible because I have two dogs, and I wrap them up in orange tape every year, and they go galloping off into the woods. So if this cuts down on the range that I can hear hunters, that concerns me a little bit, because I want to know who's out there, and for the safety of my pets, my children, and my family. So is your estimation, does that make sense to you, or would that be unfounded?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, you're still going to, in that scenario, you would still hear a loud bang. It was asked of me shortly after, or before, yeah, right after we recessed, by somebody in the audience here, if I would ever like to use one of these hunting. Well, being a duck hunter, I don't put on earbuds, I don't put on ear cups. I stand out there and I'm listening. Listening for a duck. There's no protection. As soon as a duck flies over, bang. Hopefully got him. If there's more than one, I can pull off three shots. That's three ducks in where I come from. But that first shot, my ears are ringing. Now, if I can reduce the amount of sound off of my barrel so I can shoot three shots and the impact isn't as bad, my ears aren't ringing as bad, but I guarantee all my neighbors have heard it. I'd like that. That'd be a nice little thing. And in today's society, all we're trying to do is reduce noise. That's these people live around the airports. The days of the pure jet engines are gone. We're all flying turbofans. Well, sorry. Turbofans are the thing. They're very quiet. So, and you know all about that. So, you know, that's where we're trying to go with this, is just reduce the noise.
Chair's last comment.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I appreciate the response. And, you know, noise is a problem. Representative Anderson, I appreciate the response. And, you know, noise is a problem. And, you know, my wife and I like to go to music a lot. And in Minneapolis, if you go to any club, they're required to have earplugs for you. And so it's my choice to go and to use the earplugs and to protect my health or not. So I understand what you're saying, but there should be some accountability to the user.
Okay, Representative Zerwas, Quam, Lucero, Johnson, and Ward. If you could keep them short, I'd sure appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, yeah, real brief. Just kind of a comment. You know, it struck me when Representative Rosenthal talked about, you know, equated going to a range and some inherent risk and equated it to riding a motorcycle, and it strikes me as, you know, we don't require, but we highly encourage folks to put the helmet on when you ride your motorcycle, and so I think if there's a way to make it easier or to allow people to use a basic safety measure such as a suppressor. You know, I don't know why we would dissuade that when, you know, so I think if we're going to talk about inherent risk in a hobby or an activity, then why not give people the appropriate tools to be able to mitigate that? And I think that's what this does.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm really confused by the people that seem to think the movies are real, because I know neighbors that get upset if you start one lawnmower too early on a Saturday morning, or there's a street project that's too loud. So they notice that. And if you had eight jackhammers, or if you had 32 lawnmowers starting up, I don't think you would doubt hearing or noticing. So I think it's disingenuous to continue to play as if the movies are real, when we just need to look at the facts and convey it to the reality that we notice things much quieter than that.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. So to the comments about that it wouldn't really matter, I think was one of the words. being one that has unfortunately been the victim of hearing loss. If this could save the hearing of just one person, wouldn't it be worth it?
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm probably one of the few people in this room that's actually used a suppressed weapon. The noise from them varies depending on the caliber, the type of ammunition. When we're talking 308 rifles for deer hunting or a shotgun, they cannot reduce the noise enough to that your neighbors couldn't hear it. But the safety on the gun range by just lowering the amount, because when I went out to the range with my department, we didn't have one guy out on the firing line. We had multiple people. And if the range officer is down at one end or in the middle, if you had enough guys standing on that line or officers standing on that line when we're doing our training, people at the end, because of the noise of all the rounds being fired, we had trouble hearing. But by being able to reduce that level of noise from the firing of the weapons, it'd make the range safer.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just a couple of thoughts. Proofs are mathematical. Theories are never proven, ever. So our little conversations about theories and proof are not particularly appropriate or helpful. I also would be interested in having some more data from the medical community. But the challenge with that is not only the time element here, but that falls into the category of human experience experiments. And in order to actually get the data on it, we would have to damage people's hearing and evaluate that. That's not going to happen. You know, we're not going to set people up and say, you're wearing hearing protection, you get a silencer, that kind of thing. So I think it would be really hard to do anything other than a theoretical test of some kind. I have a firing range. What do you call it, Dan? What do you call it? Training range? Outdoor firing range in my district. Private, actually, in Representative Lohmer's district, but the one in my district is public safety. And it's moving all the time. And the the people who live around that would love to have silencers used because they are subjected to a lot of the noise, like my going to college in Kansas, in Manhattan, Kansas, miles from Fort Riley, we could hear Fort Riley. It is profound noise, and it is a challenge to communities. So I actually can see it on a firing range, and I would think that we could have firing range own and keep track of the inventories of silencers to be used at firing ranges. That would be another way to do it, and maybe then people wouldn't have to go through the expense of having their own. Representative Schoen explained to me that they can't use that on the firing range for the public safety because they're operating from the holster and that sort of thing. It's just not, they can't use the silencers. So that won't work in my district. So I'm really conflicted. I appreciate the discussion, and I wish everybody luck on this.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first I want to say thank you for allowing all sides to be heard on this issue. This is the most contentious of the three bills, I think, that we're hearing today, and I think it was a very good hearing when all sides were able to not only present but then refute any issues that they might have. And members, some of us on the committee decided to take a field trip when we heard that we were going to hear this bill, and we actually went to the Minneapolis police department, and we listen to a gun, a firearm being shot without a suppressor, and then one being shot with a suppressor. And I actually took the opportunity to shoot it myself with the suppressor because I wanted to be able to articulate the difference in the sound that it made. So with the firearm without the suppressor, I put the headphones on, and then when I shot the firearm with the suppressor, I took the headphones off, and it sounded about the same. So it does reduce the sound, but it didn't dramatically reduce the sound. Then I had an issue with the shot spotters, and so I started asking questions about the shot spotter and got conflicted information about whether or not the firearm with the shot spotter would not be detected or would be detected. Many said it would not, others said it would, and you have this handout. And the last thing that I wanted to make certain that we knew the information is I contacted the folks who do the forensic to find out whether or not the suppressor would impact the forensic of a bullet being fired from a firearm, because I believe that, you know, it is our job to do due diligence on these issues that tend to bring out the passions in folks. I'm not sure we really convince each other on these kinds of issues, you know. Guns and abortion tends to be those issues that you can spend a lot of time debating and not one mind is changed. But, Mr. Chair, I really do think that we should continue to have some conversations about the timing. I had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Diebel here, and I understand the difference between the 7 days, the 15 days, and the 30 days. Clearly, you know, 7 days, a background check for the permit to purchase. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get to carry it. Then 30 days for a permit to carry so that you can check to see whether or not the person really should be walking around with a firearm. And then 15 days now for the suppressor. So I get the difference. I just want to make sure that we're really thoughtful on these issues, and I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing full debate on the issue, and look forward to the vote.
Thank you, Reverend Hilstrom. Representative Anderson, would it be okay if I went right to the motion, or do you want to say a minute closing comments?
I have nothing further to say.
Right. Representative Howard, Representative Howard, you want to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to move the bill to the final passage and move it to the final general registry.
As amended?
I forgot that. As amended.
All right. Representative Howe has moved 1434 to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carried. Thank you very much. Thank you, folks. And thank you, all the participants. We'll move into the next bill. Representative Johnson, you want to fill in for me? I'm going to make a call.
Representative Lazar, you wish to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move 830, and are we going to? I'm looking for advice to the General Register. To the General Register, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lazar, go ahead and describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we learn in the preamble of both the U.S. and the Minnesota constitutions that the purpose of government includes securing the blessings of liberty, and it is in this context both the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights were drafted and ratified, including gun civil liberties. Because all civil rights are equal in importance, and because we as government officials exist to protect civil liberties, we are horrified. The potential exists, law-abiding citizens, civil rights could be violated by mistakenly denying law-abiding citizens from exercising their right to purchase long guns while outside of Minnesota simply because the law is confusing to read. And that's what brings us here today, is House File 830 seeks to take existing law that is confusing in its nature and helps clarify it so it's just easier to read. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers. The first I'd like to bring up would be Andrew Rothman to explain some more of the history and the background of the language.
If you have any testifiers,
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. My name is Andrew Rothman, president of Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. Unfortunately, to explain this one, a very brief history lesson. In 1968, the Federal Gun Control Act restricted the purchase of firearms, and particularly rifles and shotguns, to taking place within your own state. The federal law had an exception that said it's okay to buy a rifle or a shotgun in person in a state that touches your state, a contiguous state, provided that there isn't a law against it in your state or in the other state. And so from 1968 on, it was only legal for a Minnesotan, say, to buy a gun in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, provided that there were no state laws that interfered with that. There were no state laws that interfered with that on the Minnesota side, but in an excess of clarity, the Minnesota legislature in 1969 said, we're going to say it right out front, and we're going to say it affirmatively, which doesn't usually happen. Usually laws say you can't do this. They don't say that you can do this. But this time the Minnesota legislature made an exception to make it very clear. And they wrote, notwithstanding any other law, it's legal to buy a long gun in an adjoining state as long as it's okay with that state too. And so that was fine. And it made it really easy for that gun store clerk in Des Moines or that gun store clerk in Milwaukee, back when there were gun stores there, to quickly check the book and see, oh yeah, Minnesota law says it's cool. So that's how it was. In 1986, the Federal Firearm Owners Protection Act rescinded that limitation on purchasing rifles and shotguns only in these contiguous states that touch your state, and said that it's legal to buy a long gun in person in any state in the country as long as it's okay with your state and as long as it's okay with the other state. It's already okay with Minnesota law because we don't have any laws against it. Unfortunately, from 1986 until the present, we never updated that 1969 law. And so when someone, say, Representative Cornish goes on vacation and finds himself in a gun store in Tucson, and he says, I want to buy that shotgun, the gun store clerk in Tucson opens up this huge ATF book of all the laws in all the states relating to guns, and it says, it shall be legal for a Minnesota resident to buy a gun in a contiguous state. And not being a legal scholar or a legislator, the gun store clerk would probably conclude, well, it's only legal there, and it must be illegal everywhere else. That's not the way laws work, but it's really hard to read. So in 1986 or shortly afterwards, we should have updated our law to say, yep, it's okay in any state. It's okay with us if it's okay with you. We never got around to that, and it's well beyond time in 2015 that we simply make that law readable again and let it reflect our actual law as it relates to federal law.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Dean.
So, quick question to the bill author, and also have a nonpartisan staff look at this. So as I look at this, you were discussing long guns as the implication of the federal law in 68, the Minnesota law in 69, and then the change in the federal law in 86. And when I look at House File 830, I see no mention of long guns at all, and I'm trying to verify if Section 624.71 applies only to long guns or if it applies to all firearms. Would you know that off the top of your head?
Representative Cesaro or Mr. Rothman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the law works by reference. And so in this case, it refers to the Gun Control Act of 1968, PL 9618. And that law is very specific that pistols, handguns, can only be purchased in the state where you reside, but that long guns can be purchased in any state. And so by reference, it does apply specifically to the types of firearms provided for in federal law.
Mr. Chair, so this 830 applies through federal law to only to long guns and not to handguns.
Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification about long guns versus pistols. I think that goes a long way. The question that I have is in many states, they don't have a regulation on the length of, for example, short barrel shotguns here are illegal. And so does this has no implication for even if it's legal to buy that weapon in another state, if it is not a allowable gun in Minnesota, you still can't have it. Is that correct?
Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom. It would be illegal to bring that gun back to Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lucero.
I do have one more testifier.
Please state your name for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Heather Callio. I represent the National Rifle Association Institute for Legislative Action. I would like to mention our support for this bill as far as it updates Minnesota statute to comply with federal law. And very briefly, I think we've all heard the relevant points on it. Thank you very much. I'm open for any questions.
Any questions from the members? Do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody in the public that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Lazar, do you wish to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion to move it to the General Register. House File 830.
With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to thank everybody for coming here today. We've had a lot of discussion and we're able to exercise our First Amendment right. Free speech. But I want to remind everybody we did that talking about the Second Amendment. And one of the most important things about the Second Amendment, it protects our First Amendment rights to do this free speech. So with that, this meeting's adjourned.